Today on the 21st show, the Trump administration is continuing to ramp up pressure on Iran with what's said to be the biggest buildup of American naval power in the region in decades. Last summer, the president claimed a, quote, spectacular military success after bombing nuclear sites there.
Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated.
But last week, Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, went on Fox News and said,
they're probably a week away from having industrial-grade bomb-making material.
So what is the truth here? What is happening in Iran? Did the Ayatollah really order the killing of more than 36,000 people? And ultimately, are we going to war with Iran? I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And our topic for the hour today is what's happening between the United States and Iran. We've had what is said to be the biggest naval and air power buildup in the region since we invaded Iraq in 2003, and yet the president has said little about what his intentions are. In his record-settingly long State of the Union message this week, he spent just 3.5 minutes on Iran. Here is part of what he had to say.
And just over the last couple of months with the protests, they've killed at least, it looks like, 32,000 protesters. 32,000 protesters in their own country. They shot them and hung them. We stopped them from hanging a lot of them with the threat of serious violence. But this is some terrible people. They've already developed missiles that can threaten Europe and our bases overseas, and they're working to build missiles that will soon reach the United States of America. After Midnight Hammer, they were warned to make no future attempts to rebuild their weapons program, and in particular, nuclear weapons, yet they continue starting it all over. We wiped it out, and they want to start all over again. And are at this moment again pursuing their sinister ambitions. We are in negotiations with them. They want to make a deal, but we haven't heard those secret words. We will never have a nuclear weapon. My preference.
All right, it went on from there. There you heard three potential rationales for war: supporting protesters, defeating the nuclear program, and stopping Iranian missiles. There was also a fourth. He separately mentioned Iran's support for terrorism throughout the region. So our questions for the hour today: are we going to war with Iran? And if so, why? If not, why have we sent such a significant military force to the region? You can join us throughout the program today at 800-222-9455. How do you feel about what's happening? Should the U.S. go to war with Iran? And what effect would that have at home and abroad? 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. With me today to talk more about this is Elahe Javadi, who lived in Iran for more than two decades, being born just after the revolution. She came to the United States, where she is now an associate professor at Illinois State University in Information Systems. Elahe, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Brian, for having me.
Also joining us is Matteo Mohamed Farzana, professor and chair of both history and political science at Northeastern Illinois University. He was also born in Iran. His family was displaced when Iraq invaded in 1980. He came to the U.S. in 1984. Matteo, welcome back to the 21st Show to you.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And also with us is Nicholas Grossman, political science professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, specialist in international relations, and author of the book Drones and Terror. Nick, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Matteo, let's start with the protests. What's your understanding of what brought that about back in, what, late December, early January?
So for better context, I think it's important for the listeners to realize that Iranians have been protesting in one shape or another since at least the beginning of the success of the Islamic Revolution in 79. And it's just gotten more and more pronounced, meaning because of the mismanagement of the Islamic Republic, the regime, because of the 8-year war and the catastrophe that it brought to Iran, because of the corrupt nature of the theocrats in power, and because of huge dissatisfaction, not only with how the socio-political atmosphere is, but also the economic situation that seems to be getting worse by the minute. These latest rounds of protests are nothing as of surprise. What is surprising is that since this past Christmas in late December, there was a grassroots movement to object to the massive economic degradation system that some might argue that was coming from abroad. But also, we don't need to forget that the Iranians themselves, the government, has a lot to do with that, with the mismanagement of funds and what have you. They came out on the street. They went to the bazaar or the big market in Tehran and in other places, and they were peacefully protesting. And things just got out of hand and unfortunate for tens of thousands, if not more, of people that were on the street. They met the wrath of the violent wrath of the Islamic Republic regime. And according to various numbers, anywhere between 3,000 to 32,000, that's what President Trump was saying at the State of the Union. And some other groups have it at much larger numbers. Nevertheless, one is too many in my book and many people. And we have people that have been killed that have been children, teenagers, young adults, and as old as 70 or 80 years old. So that's where we are right now.
Elahe Javadeh, I know you have a lot of connections still back in Iran. I wonder, and I also know there's been something of an information blackout, but I wonder if you've had contact. What have you heard from people there on the ground?
Yes, I would like to say hi to you and your listeners, also to my fellow panelists. I've lost a second cousin. I've lost people. I've known with 1 degree of separation, I would say. People who are connected to people who are so close to me. So this time, the protests are heavily related to economic situation. We know that Riyal hit 1.4 million to the dollar. Food prices rose 72%. Inflation is 60%, and 40% of people are living in abject poverty. So literally, people are not able to put food on the table. And for the youth, as an educator, I care about education, I care about the youth, I care about the future of the intellectual reservoir in Iran and in the Middle East. We see that education is suffering. We see that the employment is not based on merit. We see that there is 8% unemployment for people who are eligible to be effective contributors to the society. So these kids on the street, mostly a younger generation, would be my children. They have nothing to lose. And that is very clear to see. And what I hear of people who have lost their lives to this regime are mostly young people. And we have we have a wide range from 2-year-old to a 9-year-old, but most of them are between 13 and 30, and that's the main reason is that there is nothing to lose for them. The regime has been managing the society so poorly over the past 47 years that this is the last resort for the people to just be on the streets and demand a dignified life.
All right, let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are talking about what is happening in Iran with the United States military buildup and what that could mean going forward. Are we going to be attacking? What is happening there? I want to play a couple of more sound bites from the president and his Middle East envoy in that order. Let's start with last June. This is what the administration called Operation Midnight Hammer, when Well, you'll hear President Trump talk about it. This was a Saturday night last June.
A short time ago, the U.S. military carried out massive precision strikes on the three key nuclear facilities in the Iranian regime, Fordo, Natanz, and Esfahan. Everybody heard those names for years as they built this horribly destructive enterprise. Our objective was the destruction of Iran's nuclear enrichment capacity and a stop to the nuclear threat posed by the world's number one state sponsor of terror. Tonight, I can report to the world that the strikes were a spectacular military success. Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated. Iran, the bully of the Middle East, must now make peace. If they do not, future attacks will be far greater and a lot easier.
Okay, you heard him there. This is last June again. He says completely and totally obliterated. Well, then, within the last week, President Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, was on Fox News with Lara Trump, who is a daughter-in-law of the president. And you'll hear what they said in this exchange.
Based on what you've seen in the negotiations that you've been part of, what could a deal actually look like with this regime?
Well, I think the president he gave Jared and I direction before we went over there. There were red lines, zero enrichment. We have to have the material back. You know, they say that it's all about their civil program, and yet they've been enriching well beyond the number that you need for civil nuclear. It's up to 60%. They're probably a week away from having industrial grade bomb making material, and that's really dangerous. So they can't have that. This is something that they have to stick with until they prove to us that, you know, they can behave.
All right. Nicholas Grossman, I'm going to bring you in now. You know, a month ago, this was about the protests. Now it's about the nuclear weapons and the missiles. What do you make of this disconnect between President Trump and his Middle East envoy and just the very conflicting messaging we've been getting out of the administration?
It's hard to say because it's not clear they totally know either. So, totally know what they want either, or how they're about to try to achieve it. So when Trump claimed earlier that the nuclear program was totally obliterated, he was lying. He was obviously lying at the time. And I say obvious in that he was saying this before even a damage assessment was possible. And there was a lot of reports of things like a lot of trucks leaving those various sites in Iran and in the week leading up to it. And the United States is in this position because Trump in his first term got rid of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA that had been negotiated by pretty much the entire world with Iran and had restricted the Iranian nuclear program, where had accomplished a lot of the things that Steve Witkoff was just talking about, of getting the nuclear material, enriched material, out of the country, of restricting Iran's nuclear material. And every intelligence agency in the world, including America, the Pentagon, the International Atomic Energy Agency, all said that Iran was doing it. And then Trump broke the deal and let Iran out of nuclear restrictions, while saying that maximum pressure would get Iran to agree to a better deal. And that was in 2018. Here we are in 2026, and Iran has not. And so this creates a big problem for potentially trying to do negotiations, is because even as the U.S. is making demands of Iran, the Iranians, based on this experience with America and with Trump specifically, cannot trust that the U.S. will actually honor its side of the deal. So in other words, they're looking at it not as, okay, we can avoid war if we make a deal, or otherwise it's war. They're looking at it as, if we make a deal, they'll come back and demand more, or they might attack us anyway, or people inside Iran, inside the Iranian government, the ones that said that you can't trust America, you shouldn't make this deal, they're going to renege on it in some way, they're not honest. They won that argument internally in Iran, and so they have a big I told you so. So the U.S. looks like it is trying to, based on a lot of what they say, trying to get some sort of a deal rather than actually have to go through with a war. And it's noteworthy that while the buildup in the Middle East is very large, largest military buildup since the war in Iraq in 2003, It is primarily, almost entirely, air power, things that can attack from a distance, not the sort of large ground force that is necessary to make regime change actually work. So the US is set up to do potentially a lot of damage in Iran, is trying to use that as leverage to get Iranians to the Iranian government to make some sort of deal, but also is not providing any sort of credible off-ramp where Iran could make the deal. So from afar, I can't tell if the Trump administration is actually interested in war or not, if they want regime change or not. They don't have the assets for it that are in position, but that doesn't mean they might not try. Something like they did with Venezuela of just remove the leader, that wouldn't really work because, and actually it didn't really work in Venezuela either, in that the regime is intact. Everybody just moved up a spot. And Iran also is a large governing bureaucracy that if the leader was removed, other people would move up a spot and operations would continue. So it is, I'd say, unclear from anybody from the outside of what exactly the US is trying to achieve or what it would accept as a deal that works for now and whether the US would actually honor it. And it is not even clear that they know what it is they're trying to pursue, besides getting something that they can call a victory, whether that is military or diplomatic.
All right, we are going to need to take a break on the program here. Let me reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, we are talking about what has been happening in Iran and what has been happening between the United States and Iran. As we heard, there was a significant ramp up in protests late last year, early this year, with a devastating crackdown from the Iranian government. Estimates have ranged from several thousand to multiple tens of thousands of people killed by the government there in response to those protests. Meanwhile, the United States has moved a significant naval and air power force into the region, two aircraft carriers, refueling planes, bombers, that sort of thing. But it's unclear what the government is doing. We want to hear from you, 800-222-9455. You can join us today on the program. We also asked members of our texting group what they thought about this. Just to that point, we were talking about someone in Charleston, Illinois, who goes by the initial S, says 8 months ago they said they'd killed the nuclear program. Now they're a week away from having it. So which is the truth? Good question. Again, you can join us today, 800-222-9455. We'll continue after a short break. This is the 21st Show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today about the latest developments in Iran as the United States seemingly maybe is gearing up to attack the nation again with an even greater force than the bombing, relatively targeted bombing last summer. I'm going to share a few more thoughts from people in our texting group. You can join by sending the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. That's 217-803-0730. Anne in Urbana sent us a message and says, I think a war with Iran is the president's latest distraction. Not that he wouldn't follow through with war plans. He engages us with the talk of war over the table, while under the table, he's slowly dismantling the country's foundations. As long as he keeps our attention on a possible war, he can continue to work turning our country away from a democracy into a dictatorship, Anne says. Also, Jesse and Mattoon, who says, America First was clearly a bait-and-switch con. Do we even know the objective? Is there even a strategy? Give a man a hammer, and everything looks like a nail. Give Donald the U.S. military, and everyone looks like a target, Jesse says. Thanks for those messages. You can join us live today at 800-222-9455. We are talking about this with Mateo Muhammad Farzana at Northeastern Illinois University, Nick Grossman from the University of Illinois, and Elahe Javadi of Illinois State University. You can join us again, 800-222-9455. And let's go now to the phones. Paul is calling from Urbana. Paul, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, it's a complicated subject. I wanted to assert that we're already de facto at war with Iran. There have been decades of destabilization in the Baluch region by the CIA. Some legal sanctions and some illegal sanctions against Iran have just crippled and caused this change in the subsidy program for food that brought people out in the streets initially. So I think there's actually a new book out from a scholar who was on campus, Behrouz Ghamari, called The Long War on Iran. And I think it, I haven't seen it yet. It's just out. But I think it goes through that those kind of realities that never get discussed in sound bites. So another factor, and I know I'm going on, is that we don't know what happened as far as what fomented the violent aspect of this uprising. The Israeli press admits that they were in Iran. We know from the precise targeting that there have been operatives in Iran, and who knows, MEK might actually be cooperating with that kind of activity too. So it's a tragic and barbaric situation we're in, and I don't think an intervention militarily is going to actually do much good for the people of Iran overall anyway. So thanks for letting me input.
Thanks. All right, Paul, thanks for calling in. Matteo Mohamed Farzana, how about that that first item Paul mentioned there, this idea of if we've really already been at a, maybe you'd call it a Cold War, a long war with Iran. What do you think of that?
Absolutely. Thank you, Paul, for those comments. I couldn't disagree with any part of what Paul was saying, and I wrote it down here. He's absolutely right about Balochistan, which is on the eastern part of Iran bordering Pakistan. There have been a lot of operations going on, covert. How do we know? Is mostly from what the Iranians are telling us and the revolutionary courts that these people who are caught have gone through and have testified. Now, there is some speculation as to how severe these could be. I couldn't tell you because I don't know. About the legal and illegal sanctions, absolutely right. Behrouz Ghamari does a good job in Long War on Iran describing this idea that I think has been out of the bag for many, many years, but as Paul was also mentioning, not necessarily talked about in mainstream media. One of the things I think Dr. Javadi mentioned at the beginning, at Christmas time, I've seen some reports that talks about how there was a massive amount of Iranian currency that was purchased by United States and maybe Israel, but I'm not sure of that, raised the price of the currency really, really high from 1.4, from 1.1, I think it was around Christmas, and today is almost 1.7 million. So that had a huge reverberation across Iran in the markets, and people came out. So you could say that Iran has been a target of American establishment and how they want to weaken the regime and perhaps create chaos in the hope that the regime would fall apart. And one last thing that he, Paul also, our commenter, was mentioning the way the protests basically went really violent after a few days of absolutely peaceful, kind of a civilized protest that you would see in other places in the world. And all of a sudden, we had the crown prince, Reza Pahlavi, that went out and called on people to come on the streets. And then Pompeo, our ex-Secretary of State, that went on X and said to the Iranians, come out because Mossad agents are walking within you, amongst you. And then we had President Trump who told Iranians that we're not going to leave you alone. So part of this massive tragedy of killing of innocent people with political agreements, perhaps other states might be sharing that as well.
All right, if you want to join us, 800-222-9455. Alahe Javadi, can you talk about what public opinion in Iran with regards to America, with regards to the government? You know, President Trump said to the protesters, we'll be with you. Obviously, that was not the case. That has not been the case yet anyway. Take it where you will.
Absolutely. And thanks, Paul, for your questions. Paul mentioned that there are words that maybe Mossad agents or Israeli agents are on the ground and maybe they contribute to the killing of the people. A question I would like to raise on behalf of all Iranian people on the streets is that if Mossad agents or Israel had a hand in killing people on the streets, then why the Iranian regime goes to the hospitals and kills the nurses or imprison the nurses and doctors who are helping the injured? So the basic question is the claim that the Islamic regime is making, and these are the talking points by, and I fully understand that, but by people who are against a US intervention, that this is somehow outside the hand of the Iranian regime. But then the evidence shows that no, they are imprisoning a large population of doctors who went out of their way to help protesters in the back rooms or in their houses. So that claim is already debunked. And now we talk about sanctions, and I understand the viewpoints of the people in America is different, but the reality on the ground and the inflation is not about sanctions. It's about 46 years of kleptocratic theocracy, the IRGC monopolies, the apocalyptic mismanagement of human resources, natural resources, mineral resources. In fact, my dad is in geology. He's very active in what you would say in mining in Hamadan, my home province, and is also another province that my dad's side is from, Lorestan. It's the mines, the ones that are good, are all monopolized by Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. So you think about human resources, mineral resources, water resources, ecological resources, about the oil resources, about intellectual resources. These are all the things that have been actively destroyed and monopolized by one group, and that group is IRGC. Yes, sanctions are painful, and I know from personal experience, because I know people who are going through cancer treatment, and I know sanctions are impacting them. But sanctions is probably just one among hundreds of factors that have led to this moment in time that we are at. So I'm gonna again, this is a Reza Shah or Trump calling people to go on the streets. We cannot stay there. The people who are shooting these Islamic regime militia members, and in fact, my colleagues, and I'm sure Dr. Farzani knows, that they're importing militia from Iraq to put them on the streets with military-grade weapons to kill these people. Trump sent a message. Reza Pahlavi sent a message, but who is killing the people on the streets? And I'm telling you, it's my idea and 99% of the people on the ground, that this is not Mossad, this is not Trump, this is not Reza Pahlavi who is causing this chaos. It's the sole responsibilities of Islamic regime, and we are seeing the results, and the numbers are at least 32,000, and we are thinking it might be closer to 100,000.
Nicholas Grossman, do you want to respond to anything that's been said in the last few minutes?
So I just want to strongly second how much the domestic situation in Iran is Iranian, in that the most powerful force, the actor that can bring the most physical force to bear by far inside Iran, is the Iranian government and allied militias or funded militias, and that the protests are largely organic, that foreign intelligence agencies stick their nose into other people's business, of course. They do that with just about everybody, just about every situation. They try to, but there is no way they can generate hundreds of thousands, really millions of people out onto the street, braving security services. There's no way that they can do those individual killings and arrests in the tens of thousands. That is simply beyond them. And while other countries have some role, of course, and the United States certainly has been adversarial with Iran since the 1979 revolution, that the part of the protests and the violent crackdown on the protesters is from the Iranian people and the Iranian government.
All right. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I want to talk a little bit about what Iran's goals are here, strategic goals. I read an interview some years ago with an Israeli military intelligence person who had sort of, you know, was regarded as a thoughtful person on this stuff, had studied the Iranian government. I'm just going to read an excerpt here. This person was Amos Yadlin. He said, they regard their struggle with America and Israel as a clash of civilizations. As they see it, their civilization is the more pure and more just, and therefore it is stronger. The Judeo-Christian civilization is for them an evil imperialist civilization that's now in a state of decline. They feel genuine rage because of what the British and the Americans and the Russians did in Iran and because of what the Zionists did in Palestine. They are totally convinced that because our civilization is spoiled and corrupt, it cannot endure suffering, has no resilience, and is bound to rot. And that's why they have no doubt that they will have the upper hand and eventually bring about the downfall of Israel, Europe, and America. The future is theirs. They believe their rising culture will topple ours. Matteo Mohamed Farzan, I wonder what you make of that assessment of the Iranian government, revolutionary government.
Whenever I hear the term clash of civilization anywhere, I kind of cringe because I don't think there's a clash. There's an encounter. And as far as Iranians are concerned, historically, setting aside the evil empire proposal that this author was talking about, people need to remember that in 1951, Iranians went to the polls and they elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. And the CIA and the MI6 got together, and there was a huge influence of the oil companies out in Texas, based on new information that's coming out, that convinced Washington that they need to go and destroy this newly elected government simply because Mossadegh nationalized the oil company and took it out of the hands of the British. So the first and foremost problem that Iran has with the West, specifically with the United States, is its involvement in the coup of 1953 that most people are familiar with right now. And not to want to change the subject, but at the same time, these negotiations, like you mentioned, I think Dr. Grossman was mentioning at the top of the hour, it's a matter of trust. I think if Iranians, and I'm not siding with any particular group, if Iranians are given a chance to decide for themselves what they want, absolutely they will choose peace, whether or not we can somehow remove this regime peacefully or through other diplomatic means, because I'm totally against violence against anyone, including Israelis, Americans, and Iranians. If we could do that, I think the chances that Iranians and Americans and everybody else can get along just fine. One more thing that I wanted to mention also, if I may, I don't know if we're going to talk about it, I'll just put it out there since I have the microphone now. One of the things that is kind of interesting in the current negotiation that's going on with Witkoff Kushner and the Iranian Foreign Minister, Abbas Araghchi, is the United States chose not to send diplomats, not to send people that work for the Department of Energy, as it was the case during the JCPOA. Negotiations 10 years ago, and it sent business people. It sent Witkoff and Kushner. And I have a gnawing suspicion that this is going to turn out to be a negotiation for perhaps business deals that Trump is thinking about, that its organization will do with the Islamic Republic when they put their differences aside at some time. Does that mean we're not going to have war? I think we're going to have a limited war, but I think the ultimate case would be for Donald Trump, and the way he thinks and the way he operates is how to get American businesses there, but first and foremost, how he can actually benefit from it personally.
My goodness, a Trump golf course, Tehran, is that where we're heading towards here, do we think?
Well, it's been said before, Trump Towers in Tehran and Mashhad and Tabriz and all over the place. And who knows? I'm not in the room, and I don't think any of us on this show is in the room as to what they're talking about. But somebody needs to respond to this gnawing suspicion. Why don't we have diplomats negotiating this, but quote-unquote business people?
Yeah, the president's son-in-law who's gotten billions of dollars in investment from other governments in the region, and a real estate guy that the president is tasked with this. Great, great points. All right, we're going to continue this conversation. We need to take another break. If you want to join us, still the number is 800-222-9455. We're talking with Matteo Mohamed Farzana, Elahe Javadi, and Nick Grossman from the University of Illinois. We're going to continue after a short break. 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about Iran, what's been happening there, and the prospect of another American attack on the country. Another text message. Randy in rural Peoria County says, another war. They never reached their goals. Did we ever try real, true communication? I want that to be at least tried. And Gina in Springfield says, because the United States, Russia, and other nations store nuclear weapons, it strikes me we should not insist that Iran eliminate its own nuclear and uranium stores. I realize that various Iran regimes have been very brutal over the years, but I still cannot see justification for insisting that Iran eliminate something that helps that nation protect itself. My guests for our conversation today are Nicholas Grossman, professor in political science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, author of Drones and Terror. We're also talking with Matteo Mohamed Farzana, professor and chair of history and political science at Northeastern Illinois University. He was born in Iran, came here in the 1980s. And Elahe Javadi, who also lived in Iran for more than two decades before coming to the U.S., and she is now associate professor in information systems at Illinois State University in Normal. Again, if you want to join us, 800-222-9455. Elahe Javadi, can you respond either to, what Gina had said there, that, you know, maybe the government should be allowed to pursue nuclear weapons for self-protection? What do you think of that argument?
Yes, absolutely. Iran is not only killing its own people, it's blackmailing governments around the the universe as well. It's attacking bases in the Middle East, U.S. bases in the Middle East. So a nuclear Iran would be more like a nuclear North Korea, only that it's going to have impact for a larger group of people, because Iran is not sitting and it proactively pursues violations of several international protocols. So what you see is that already Iran is supporting Hamas, Hezbollah, and Houthis. So a nuclear Iran will be a Middle East on fire all the time for the future generations. And I would say that Iranian people are paying the price right now, but it would be the U.S. generations after us who will be paying the price as well. Because Iran has proven it's not a trustworthy government. It pursues proactively conflicts. And what they have done also, I would like to add to what Dr. Farzana shared, is that Trump is sending businessmen because there is some business deal to be done. There are some benefits to be gained. But what I hear from people on the ground is that even if Trump benefited or if U.S. benefited from this deal, a regime change serves the Iranian people far more. Let's say America brings investment, or there is Trump Tower in Tehran or in Mashhad in Hamadan. That would bring employment. That would bring prosperity. Whereas now, IRGC does the same thing. It exploits Iranian wealth while families are starving, while there is a high number of unemployment. There is massive brain drain. While I see the future of Iran academia suffer immensely, because just as of 2025, 150,000 educated people, highly educated people, have fled the country. So maybe there is benefit for the U.S., but that still is a better deal for Iranian people, and a better deal for the Middle East, and a better future situation for U.S. Children and grandchildren than what we see here, because we're going to see prosperity, we're going to see freedom, we're going to see communication, and we're going to see peace in the Middle East that is largely suffering from the Iranian nuclear ambitions. And just keep in mind that the Iranian IRGC children, they're all safe. They are in England, they are in Australia, they are living in the best neighborhoods of California or in Canada. So the people who are suffering in the country are not those. They know that this is not a country to live in. So they're destroying the country while their children are living a luxurious life outside Iran. So it would be me, an average kid who had to flee. It would be an average family like my friends in Iran who have made lives. You know, there are specialty surgeons, like they made lives in Iran and now they have to think about immigration. So I would say that whatever agenda U.S. is pursuing right now, it seems to be a better option for Iranian people on the ground, and I say for my child as well, who is being raised in America, because the future will be a more peaceful future with Iran that is not a nuclear Iran, and a new government that respects freedom and respects prosperity and respects equality.
Just for our listeners' benefit, the IRGC, that's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the sort of elite military unit there. Nick Grossman, I'm torn between wanting to talk about just the unusual nature and the sort of confused diplomatic position of the U.S. here, or the greater nuclear question. I don't know, maybe you can, where should we go with this in the time we have remaining?
I can sort of do them both, related ones, of where a reason why the world is a consensus or close to it of the international community doesn't want anybody else to have nuclear weapons, that there are all the reasons specific to Iran where a lot wouldn't, but the more people that have nuclear weapons, the greater possibility of things like accidents or miscalculation, of a terrorist stealing one, of somebody selling one on the black market, any of those other problems multiply. And when one country gets it, then it is much harder to prevent its various rivals and neighbors from trying to get it. And so even if somebody is very sympathetic to Iran, and we can understand why Iran would want a nuclear weapon to give itself a deterrent, give itself at least a degree of parity with nuclear-armed United States, nuclear-armed Israel. But even if we were very sympathetic to that argument, then if Iran does get a nuclear weapon, then the Saudi Arabia wants one, and Turkey wants one, and Egypt wants one. And then again, all those problems multiply. So that also traces back to when a caller said that it would be good if we tried real diplomacy. And this is part of the problem, is that we did, that it was a bipartisan effort in the United States through the Bush and Obama administrations. It was a multilateral effort. It was hardly just the U.S. It was the U.S. and China and Russia and the Europeans and the United Nations all doing it together. And that actually got Iran to make a real nuclear deal that restricted a lot of their capabilities. And this is why Dr. Farzana's point about the U.S. sending businessmen that are personal business associates or relatives of the president, rather than, say, nuclear scientists, is because when we sent nuclear scientists, they were able to work out a lot of intricate details about just what Iran is allowed to do that would be carefully restricted to things like electricity generation or medical research, which nobody can deny others getting as, or I guess you can try to deny it, but it's a very hard argument to say things like you should not have more advanced anti-cancer techniques, for example. You're not allowed to research that. And a lot of that tech is quite old, is decades old, that, and then they would be prevented from it. But then Iran agreed to the deal because they were able to do some activities with it, but were carefully restricted from things that would get them closer to a nuclear weapon in various ways. And with the United States now not sending nuclear scientists, there is no way they're going to work out those details, potentially diplomatically. Part of the problem with observing this is that a bluff to try to generate leverage for negotiations and preparation for a real war look the same until somebody starts shooting or backs down. But the US has not brought the type of diplomatic and expertise capacity that could actually get a deal that would restrict Iran's nuclear program, and so is likely to find itself in a position of having to bomb with very limited ability or back down. And so while there are many that would advocate a regime change in Iran, or hoping that the regime will change, especially that it will democratize, that it will be a freer country, that the Iranian people can be safer and freer and more prosperous, that the way to make that happen, especially by force from the outside, is extremely difficult and can create a lot more problems than it solves. And we have the recent example of the regime change in Iraq and the Iraq War, which, among other things, greatly empowered Iran by removing their biggest Sunni Arab rival in Saddam Hussein, and also gave rise to ISIS.
Mateo Mohammed Farzana, what do you think about that? People in America have been hoping and working for a government change in Iran since, what, 1979? What do you think are the prospects of that?
You know, I find Dr. Grossman, Dr. Javadi's comments both agreeable to a certain extent. Let me address what Dr. Javadi was saying. A nuclear Iran, if it were under the right circumstances, not with this regime that's been abusing its own citizens for 47 years, would probably not be a good idea. And I do agree that if they have it, then a nuclear Iran only is going to guarantee the regime's life and its behavior, and it's going to be very difficult to challenge it. The part with Dr. Grossman that I agree with, and I think you will hardly find anyone that would disagree, other than if there are war hawks or anti-Iranian for whatever reason, is the idea that since Iran is the signatory to NPT, the non-proliferation treaty. Sorry about that. Then it's really hard to convince the world that if you are signatory to an agreement that says you cannot create or make nuclear weapons, you have every right as a sovereign nation to create your own nuclear program that is peaceful. And I think we're kind of between a rock and a hard place right now, because like Dr. Grossman was mentioning, this buildup of this massive military capability, which is mostly aerial and not so much groundwork, somebody needs to show that they did something with this massive investment of taking things over there. But let me say something also perhaps not so conventional, that this could all be part of a bluffing, the way Donald Trump bluffs. We've seen how he talks. We've seen how he behaves. We know a certain amount of information about how he conducts his business. He bluffs and he kind of shifts his weight around to convince people to do things. If that's what he's thinking, then it might not work, because during the Iran-Iraq war, if anybody knows the history of that, Iranians were quite a bit pushed to do things that they didn't want to do, and they didn't do it. And the war lasted for 8 years at heavy cost for not only Iranians, but the Iraqis as well. This could be a second instance where Iran is going to demonstrate that resolution, that it will not abide by what it's told, but it will negotiate if it's dealt with dignity. And the word dignity comes up quite a bit in negotiations going back 20, 25 years. And various foreign ministries of Iran have always talked about it. And that's the difference you will get when you're negotiating with the people that believe they have a civilization that's older than most other nations in the world.
That is going to have to be the last word. Mateo Mohammed Farzana is professor and chair of history and political science at Northeastern Illinois University. Elahi Javadi is a professor in information systems at Illinois State University, and Nicholas Grossman in political science, professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, also author of the book Drones and Terror. Thank you all so much for sharing your perspectives with us today here on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having us.
That is all the time we have for our program today. Coming up on Monday's show, we are going to be talking about the Tuskegee Airmen. They've been celebrated for their military victories and for breaking racial barriers in the World War II era Army. But 27 of them went missing in action. Most were never recovered. And their stories are the subject of a new book, Forgotten Souls. It's by the Illinois-born and Illinois-raised author Cheryl Whitlow Thompson of NPR. We will talk with her Monday on the 21st Show. You can find a podcast of this program wherever you listen to podcasts. We're on Apple, Spotify, YouTube. Just search for Illinois Public Media there. You can also find links to our podcasts at our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can also find all the ways to contact us via email, text message, voicemail, and you can find our series of interviews with candidates for U.S. Senate. That is a growing list. We're up to 13 now. That's all at 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again on Monday.